This programming is sponsored by the Near Northwest Management District, located just off 290 and the 610 Loop, with a mixture of modern and mid-century homes providing families room to grow. More information at nnmd.org.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Thanks for joining us and talking a little politics, both national and state politics. Jay, this week, a lot going on. We've got State of the State address. We've got a State of the Union address. So we can talk about all that stuff. But to start with, we are rolling off the rails of the crazy train. 2020 continues to mount up. What is going on, Jay, in the world of presidential politics?
It's like election palooza for us, right? I mean, it's like every minute there's a new Democratic candidate running for the nomination. We got Cory Booker, who has thrown his hat in with
news of the week
with a nice little viral video, or attempted to go viral. It was high production value. He is the current United States Senator from New Jersey, former mayor of Newark, New Jersey, a leading advocate.
Former NFL and college football player,
that's
too.
That's right. He was a star at Stanford University. And he's been a leader in criminal justice reform, gives very impassionate speeches. At times can be a little bit over the top.
Too passionate.
If that's possible. Yeah, not the most measured when it comes to that. But we gave kind of an interesting difference in terms of message, was a lot more optimistic. Kind of a little bit, dare I say, Beto-esque in our better, trying to strive towards our better angels. Speaking of Beto-esque, Beto was on the couch, Brandon, with Oprah Winfrey. What are we going to make out of that?
Well, he again teased he might run for president, so we'll see. I think things are still in a bit of a holding pattern. I think the problem for him is just sort of, as you imply, that every week you've got new people who are stepping into the race. They're gobbling up all the money, all the endorsements. We already have Cory Booker and Kamala Harris who are calling members of Congress and state legislators to get their endorsements. So the train has left the station here, and if O'Rourke's not careful, he's going to be basically behind. To put it this way, maybe he'll be blocking and tackling for Cory Booker, right, who would be one of the few presidents who ultimately had played some professional sports. Also, Gerald Ford, who was more of a tackling dummy at Michigan, but still, he gets credit for having played. Now, get this. Okay, Cory Booker, I think, is a real top-level candidate here. I think he's got the kind of passion that Democrats want to see. I think he has a sort of Obama-esque sort of drive to him that people like. He announced this on the first day of February, right, which is the beginning of Black History Month. So there's a kind of symbolism there. I think the problem for him is that he's taken a lot of money from Wall Street and from Big Pharma. Now, he's definitely pushed for legislation to close loopholes, and he opposes efforts to soften Dodd-Frank. He's also been, I think, really, honestly, sort of on the side of trying to figure out ways to make prescription drug prices come down. So I do think there's some pluses there that might sell, but he's going to have some explaining to do. And he's a vegan, and he's not married. So just, I mean, you know, we think about this in the context of everyone else is running. Is this a problem for him?
Well, I think we haven't even gotten to the point that, you know, the teachers' unions loathe him.
Uh-huh.
He was a huge voucher advocate in Newark.
Yes, when he was mayor of Newark.
And look, organized labor matters in Democratic primary politics, still does, particularly in some of these early states. I think someone like Booker would be even more interesting if you didn't have kind of versions of the same candidate. Mm-hmm. The thing that I find fascinating is everyone running are kind of in that same left-ish lane right now. You know, we've got another candidate on the horizon. Sunday is the announcement, expected announcement of Amy Klobuchar, the senator from the state of Minnesota. A little more centrist, like Kamala Harris, was a former prosecutor, former attorney general. They talk about her as Minnesota nice.
Yeah.
She is the kinder, gentler version of Kamala Harris. It'll be an interesting position. She's from the Midwest. Huge probable advantages in Iowa in terms of base of support. She's certainly not one to, I think, sleep on.
That lane is pretty crowded, so she's going to have to do something to separate herself, especially now that, you know, we're months into this already. Elizabeth Warren also made news this week, Jay. Apparently, she indicated on her Texas bar exam application that she was Native American. So do you think that this continuing kind of saga is just embarrassing, or does it actually hurt her politically?
Well, it's certainly embarrassing. I think anytime you're continuously having to rehash a scandal over and over and over again that you think is over, I think this, again, speaks to the fact that she wasn't really open and honest about it. There was probably no benefit in doing it this way. There's no indication she ever did it on any application in terms of applying for a job or seeking any benefit in terms of when she attended law school at the University of Houston, for example. None of that. This was just something that she self-identified, and I think it just becomes an embarrassment for her. But again, when you have 20 choices and all you're hearing are the negative things, not the positive things, it can become a problem.
Well, and if you're explaining you're losing, especially when a crowded field like this, this has been the primary of I'm sorry so far, right? Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, all both saying that they regret their perspective from the 1990s on criminal justice, Cory Booker having to explain Wall Street and pharmaceutical donations. So this is going to be a lot of kind of mea culpa happening, and we'll see how that plays out. Hey, speaking of mea culpa, Jay, Virginia and the politics there are in a state of chaos. So what is going on out there in the Commonwealth, and what politically does it mean for us?
Sure. Governor Ralph Northam, who was recently elected while a medical student, there was a yearbook photograph depicting not just a clear picture of him, but also a picture in the top right corner of two individuals, one in blackface and the other in a Ku Klux Klan costume.
Yikes. Now, he first said he was sorry. Then he said it wasn't him. So is it him or not?
Well, that's the issue here, right? I think this is a great example of if he had initially said, I didn't know about it, this is not me, was very unequivocal about it, I think he might have been able to sort of, it could have been, a teachable moment. I think the problem which you have now is it's unclear whether he was he lying then or lying now. And he went further in his statement where he basically said he knows it wasn't him because he did in fact wear a little blackface for a Michael Jackson dance contest, which is a visual I just don't really want.
Well, and they asked him at the press conference, can you still moonwalk? And his wife had to say it would be inappropriate for him to do that.
Yeah, like, it was terrible.
That wouldn't be obvious to him anyway, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is just, he's got to go. Every Democrat has told him.
There's been a lot of pushback on the IRS.
Yeah, essentially everyone has told him that he has lost sort of the moral authority to govern. Democrats have, I think, been pretty consistent about this. Some have criticized, you know, have made the argument that, you know, this is Democrats kind of eating their own. But I think that there is a sort of a zero tolerance level that we saw some of this with Al Franken, where he, you know, immediate pushback and he quickly resigned. Nobody wants Ralph Northam to stay. Both United States senators from Virginia are telling him to go. His predecessor, Terry McAuliffe, is telling him to go. The entirety of the Congressional Black Caucus, the Speaker of the House, every presidential candidate, pretty much everyone but Barack Obama has told him to go, but he's still not going.
This is interesting, yeah, because the very heart of how governors continue to survive while in office during scandals is that they can essentially maintain their political survivability. And it seems like he's got it. I mean, so far, although there have been members who've called for his resignation, he has generated enough connection to be surviving this so far. So we'll see how the week plays out. But that's, I think, exactly as you say, something which in today's Democratic politics has no tolerance for that. And so anybody who's running for anything needs to, like, check their yearbook voters for any kind of, you know, disgusting behavior like this. But the real reality here, I think, is even more problematic for not only the Democrats in Virginia, who are hoping to take back the state house and hoping to actually, you know, continue to put wins on the board in a state which is turning more blue, but also for Democrats in 2020, who would get a major advantage if they had more support in the state. The Democrats, especially in Virginia, do not want to be talking about this for the next year or 2 years. So this is something that it would be better off maybe if he just left.
Well, Brandon, let's shift gears to the federal government. We have a new Secretary of the Interior who has been the acting secretary for the last, the last year now, when Ryan Zinke had to step down in the middle of scandal. The president's been, I think, heavily criticized for having acting and interim positions for many key positions. Tell us a little bit about our new Interior Secretary.
Yeah, so the real kind of controversy here is that he was a lobbyist and worked for past clients, including oil companies and others with business before the Interior Department. He's had to step away and recuse himself on a bunch of matters. In fact, I read a report that said that he has so many of these conflicts that he has to carry a card in his pocket that lists them in case that comes up in some kind of conversation. Environmental groups are pushing back because they're worried that he's going to continue to kind of open up public lands for drilling and mining. I think the reality here is that this is probably more like par for the course. I mean, the president promised to kind of take the politics out of this process, but that's virtually impossible, especially in the Interior Department. the likelihood is it's going to go. I mean, I don't know what you think, but like, he's already got support from key members of the committee, including Joe Manchin, who last night we saw at the State of the Union was standing and clapping for, you know, the sort of energy independence of the country. And given where the Senate is, I suspect he's going to get confirmed without much trouble.
Yeah, David Bernhardt, who is the acting interior, who's been who's the president's nominee, who we're talking about. Bernhardt was a lobbyist, and a lobbyist for the coal industry and for fossil fuels as a whole. The big issue here is that this office is a significant one in that it controls large amounts of the nation's land and who can and cannot drill in it. And we've already seen some pushback in terms of opening up forest land and protected wildlife for access for oil and gas drilling. They're issuing leases, and now in Alaska and the Anwar region, which hadn't been done before. So this is all sort of, I think, consistent with that. And some of that criticism, I think, is very warranted. So we'll see how it goes. I bet it's a party line vote, and I bet he passes.
Yeah, it's going to likely pass. Actually, it might not be quite party line, because I think Joe Manchin may back him, as he did for the interim role.
Well, so. I think these days it's getting pretty close to think of Joe Manchin as a party line vote for the Republicans.
Well, a party because he's a Republican more than a Democrat, right? Yeah, that's probably a good point. Well, the president, of course, has got a lot of things to think about. What better way to make sure that happens than to schedule a bunch of time to just sit and think, Jay?
So yes. Copies of the president's itinerary, you know, sort of daily schedule. It's been commonplace to kind of put them out there. And we see oftentimes, you know, presidents are, you know, they're working in the Oval Office. They're doing lots of things. They're taking lots of meetings. Presidents routinely work very long hours. George W. Bush famously kept really tight 8-hour days, but they were filled 8-hour days. Donald Trump is an outlier in that he spends a good chunk of the day in what has been dubbed executive time. And clear as we can tell, the only real definition of executive time is the president watching Fox News or whatever private time he needs.
It's extremely broad. The report suggests that about 60% of the scheduled time for the president is executive time, which is undefined. And the White House suggests this is not just the president goofing off and, you know, playing Clash of Clans on his phone. This is the president taking phone calls and, you know, calling people and getting organized and reading. So it's a little hard to know. I mean, I've looked at the president's daily diary, which if anyone's interested, you can go and look at almost every president since Eisenhower. These are all online. You can see the schedule the presidents keep. They tend to be pretty detailed, right? So it's definitely the case that even considering a kind of unique workflow for the president, President Trump, the fact that he tends to spend less time with members of Congress or with national security staff is pretty apparent, but it's really hard to know what this executive time exactly means. So I guess I'm in the point where it'd be nice if you could see more progress and you could see him doing things, but I'm not sure it suggests he's not working.
You know what's an even bigger mystery than what is or is not executive time is the president's just ever glowing tan.
You know what I think it is? I think it's good genes. That's what it is, right?
Apparently so. So the president of the United States, who's famously been ridiculed at times for sort of having this kind of orange glow, which most people attribute to kind of what we see as spray tans.
Which would totally be consistent with the way it looks and, you know,
right.
The way people act.
But rather than, I think, own that, the president's, at least the White House, has come out with statements that essentially said that the president's tan is the result of good genes.
His color looks like something in between a carrot and a construction cone. It is so bizarre. It has to be some kind of a tanning thing, right? If it's a cream, if it's a, like, you know, the bed, if it's just the face thing, like, this is Tangate, Jay. And I think that the important thing is that why would the White House lie about this, right? Of all of the things you could lie about, of all of the kind of credibility that you're willing to stretch, why stretch it on this thing, which is so obvious, right? James Comey actually was quoted in the story that broke this New York Times, talked about like the fact that he clearly is wearing like the little eye protectors in some kind of a tanning booth because around his eyes it's white and everything else is that bright orange. So it's clear this is happening, and yet they would still not tell the truth about it. I think that is the real fundamental problem.
Yeah, and you see this all the time. It's like the lies on little things.
Yes.
It stretches all the way to, and we're going to talk about it during the State of the Union, deciding to malign the crime rates of El Paso or the needs for certain things, right? And so you get into a situation where it becomes a mystery. Well, speaking of El Paso, and we're going to talk about the president's State of the Union speech, let's shift gears, talk a little Texas, Brandon. We've got a lot going on here. We got a big legislative session going on, a lot of action. The The governor's got his state of the state. But before we get to that, let's go back to politics and talk about Senator John Cornyn, the other senator from Texas, the senior senator. He came out with some impressive fundraising numbers. He is, you know, there was a lot of talk about him not running for re-election. He showed no signs of that with these really good, solid numbers. He's brought in a campaign staff. How vulnerable is John Cornyn in this kind of new dynamic?
I think he's still vulnerable. I mean, he admitted that Texas is more of a swing state than it was, so he understands that. And I think that's kind of the first part of this, right? Knowing that there's a problem. So he is not going to back down. The price tag for the 2018 race was, what, like $130 million? So the money he put in the bank, about $6 million, like you said, is pretty good and clearly shows he's organizing. But that's not going to be sufficient. Here's the other thing, and that is that the number of Republicans in Texas voting in presidential election years has stagnated since about 2000 at about 4 million. The number of Democratic voters is increasing. So we're talking literally about almost a 50-50 split. So that's a real problem. Then again, John Cornyn has been somebody who has better ties. He's not as unpopular as Cruz. And Will Hurd, the member of Congress from the border region, has shown that you can cross President Trump and still maintain your kind of Republican credibility. If anybody can do it, it's Big John Cornyn, and I think he needs to bring back the Big John Cornyn ads, Jay. You know what I'm talking about.
I love those ads. Those were the best ads he's ever done.
Listeners, if you have not seen it, pause the podcast, Google search Big John Cornyn, and you will see what we're talking about.
Yeah, I agree with you on there. I think Cornyn is vulnerable in the sense that, well, two things have to come into play. One, the Democrats have to nominate the right kind of candidate that could potentially challenge him.
That's a great point, yeah.
And a lot of it's going to depend on the quality of that candidate, how strong they are. You know, we can talk about, you know, whether Joaquin Castro fits that bill or if Julian Castro doesn't run or Beto O'Rourke decides. Those are quality candidates. Those are marquee candidates. They could be serious challengers. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it depends on who he gets. I think first time less known candidates are going to have a bigger struggle getting the kind of excitement needed in a state this large because it costs a lot of money to run here. But two things I would say with John Cornyn, while he is certainly more popular with more moderate Republicans, he's less popular with hardcore Republicans. And one of the things that is completely diminished or underestimated with Ted Cruz is the advantage that Cruz has historically had in getting votes in the Valley because of a Spanish surname identification.
Yeah.
John Cornyn doesn't do that.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why Cruz has, in many ways, he trades moderate Republicans with Latino surname candidates.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting to see what happens. Cornyn's in the fight for a strong fight. He may or may not have a primary. We don't know that yet. But I think that's going to be a great race to watch.
You know, outreach efforts are key. I mean, he's been reaching out to Latinos and also to Asian Americans. In fact, last time he ran, he didn't have much of a race. And so he was investing a lot of money in those communities. So will it pay off? If it does, that's a model Texas Republicans can recreate. If it doesn't, there's pretty much no hope, right?
Brandon, Attorney General Ken Paxton is back in the news. This time, he is taking calls for voter fraud and abortion-related crimes, and he wants to prosecute them. He is, you know what? If no one else is going to fight the culture wars, Ken Paxton is going to fight them just by himself.
This is his sweet spot, right? Yeah, so he's asking the legislature for millions of more dollars to prosecute election fraud and human trafficking crimes, as well as abortion-related crimes. Now, they claim the district attorneys aren't enforcing pro-life laws. District attorneys push back and say there aren't many of these prosecutions to actually be had. So there is a kind of disconnect there. Most AGs don't have this kind of power in most states, right? They do pretty much the kind of basic things representing the state in some fundamental ways. So this is a power play and a political play, I think, as much as it is an actual sort of institutional need. So I'm not sure that the legislature might go for this, but a Republican legislature might go for this.
Well, I mean, if you think about it from the perspective of this session is not one where you're seeing a lot of red meat on the social issues. You've got an attorney general that wants to kind of push these issues, who's kind of made his bones as the guy that's willing to take on the federal government at every turn. I mean, this is kind of consistent with his brand.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is when you're seeing the governor and the speaker, and to a lesser extent, the lieutenant governor, attempt to kind of moderate a bit to try to get back some of those suburban voters, Ken Paxton will have nothing about that. He wants to continue to kind of stay in his lane and continue to go after those same cohorts of voters and we'll see if it pays off for him.
Do you think this is a kind of push for Paxton to reclaim that conservative mantle and maybe to use that as a basis to run? Because, look, I mean, I think Abbott and Patrick are probably kind of one cycle away from retirement. So is Paxton the kind of next up? And does this signal that this is kind of his intention to return the Republican Party to that conservative core values?
Yeah, I know. I think that's a good analysis there. I think the issue to me is, you know, we've talked a lot about Ken Paxton's sort of political vulnerabilities in large part because of the legal issues around him.
Yeah.
He might be calculating in 4 years' time it's done for him. That issue is done in that he now has an opportunity. Although I will say this, he famously talks about the next governor of Texas being his wife. So this could be a much broader strategy.
So it's Lady Macbeth that's going to be in charge, right? Well, speaking of controversy, Jay, this week we don't tend to talk about nominations in the state as being controversial, but we have one. David Wheatley, who is up for the Secretary of State's position, nominated by the governor, has been criticized for a flawed data analysis that he has sent last week, which we talked about, to about all of the county chairs or all of the local county officials, that about 100,000 non-citizens were illegally registered to vote. It turns out that that's probably not the total number, that more than 20,000 names have been wrongly included, and there are other issues. This has brought on a whole rash of criticism. It's brought on a bunch of lawsuits, four total as of this week. Is he going to have a problem getting confirmed, and what are the political implications of it?
Well, I think there's two issues here. One, I don't think he's going to get a problem getting confirmed, largely because the Republicans dominate the Texas Senate so much that that he should slide through. But I think what's going to happen is a pretty nondescript ceremonial office, in large part, that had been largely nonpartisan,
yeah,
is now suddenly thrust into the light of this continuing kind of political question about voter fraud and voter ballot access, right? Sort of the two competing arguments that you see from the left and the right. And now this nomination is going to be used as a vehicle to have that conversation. And I think you've already seen sort of some criticism about him, pretty pronounced criticism. Look, let's be clear. Secretary of State's office has completely walked back everything on this issue. You know, the names that they put out for the most part are completely wrong. They fully acknowledge that, which is one of the reasons why they said it was a weak match. The problem was it was immediately politicized. Mm-hmm. It became viral, became a national story. You had the president retweeting it. And so that's where the cause of it is. But I think it keeps the issue front and center. And that's in many ways beneficial to both sides. Yeah. Republicans want to talk about voter fraud. And Democrats really now want to talk about ballot access, voter intimidation. Mm-hmm. Those two competing themes are really what we're talking about now.
And Democrats also want to point out that a lot of this analysis is flawed or too small to worry about. So I think that's a good point. Most nominations in the state are as boring as this year's Super Bowl, so we don't ever talk about it. But this is one, I think, where it really is meaningful. I think it's smart, frankly, for Governor Abbott to politicize this office. I mean, this is an office where nothing much happens, right? So if they want to have another kind of player on this team, that's a good way to do it. The question for me is, during the hearings, whether or not they'll double down on this claim and, you know, reassert that this is a problem, or whether they'll walk it back and try to maintain a kind of nonpartisan viewpoint. So that's, I think, the big thing to watch. But I honestly, as you imply, think that they're going to be able to back down from this because politically it's good for them.
Well, look, let's talk about the state of the state here that happened, because one of the criticisms that were made was that this issue didn't have any role in the state of the state. So I'd argue they've already started walking back, but the governor put out, I think, a pretty good state of the state message. Talk school finance reform, teacher pay raises, property tax relief, school safety, disaster response. We here in the Harvey infected Houston, that's important to us. Mental health programs. This sounds like the state of the state of like George W. Bush,
right?
Not the state of the state of the guy who talked about sanctuary cities last session, or changing the U.S. Constitution to rein in federal power, or border security back in 2015. This is, dare we say, a kinder, gentler Greg Abbott. So my underlying view of this is the midterms had an effect, and they are front and center. It's all about the suburbs. It's all about places like Fort Bend County and Montgomery County and Williamson County. They want to keep all those suburban voters back. bring them back, I should say, so that they don't lose the state.
Yeah, this is the era of good feelings, apparently. And we'll see how long it lasts, but at least the governor's trying to find some bipartisan movement, calling out many members who are Democrats, like when they talked about the backlog of rape kits, talking about veterans' health care. Those are moments where I think you could find a lot of bipartisan support. So you're going to see some of these things rocket through. But as you say, some of the things he didn't talk about were as important as those that he did. So he didn't mention local control. He didn't talk about religious liberty, which is going to be a big issue for Dan Patrick. He didn't talk about voter fraud. And he also did not mention unfunded mandates on counties, which he talked about in the inaugural. So that, I think, is really telling and probably is a result of the fact that he wants to get some wins on the board, right? I mean, he recognizes that without that kind of support, you're not going to be able to move anything. The other thing that occurred to me was that this is a really spendy session, right? You're talking about teacher pay, school finance, property tax caps, which we talked about a little bit last week, school safety, Harvey funding, border security, which has already been for the past 4 years funded at each two-year increment at about $800 million. This is a very spendy session for a Republican who typically, you know, tend to be more budget conscious.
And mental health programs.
Yeah.
And he did not put border security as one of his priority items, but he did mention, he certainly mentioned it. But, I, you know, from my perspective, I think, look, the Democrats, and because some of the responses to it are what was interesting to me, rather than sort of coming up with their counter to, yes, we want school finance reform, here's our plan, here's our idea, property tax relief, here's the Democratic version of property tax relief, they, for the most part, were critical that he didn't talk about the voter fraud issue. He didn't talk about some of these. And I think the danger for them is this. Greg Abbott and the Republicans recognize that the difference in Texas elections is suburban Texas.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Democrats are fully engaged in that, and they may be fighting a wrong fight here.
Yeah. Hey, from the state of the state to the state of the union, the president gave a pretty long speech last night, Jay. Ultimately, I thought he tried to bring people together, but it was more bipolar than bipartisan, right? He's shifting from talking about how there's a caravan coming and the whole room groans to, you know, talking about the border wall, which has been a serious source of contention, to talking about eliminating HIV and combating childhood cancer. Like, just the pulling and tugging from, like, these different issues, I think, is going to create a really mixed signal. So I don't know that much is going to get done as a result of this. But what was your take?
Well, first off, I thought the speech was just terribly constructed.
It was a little rough.
Yeah, I think part of the problem was is that whoever wrote it did a great job. And it looks like someone cut and pasted different sections into different spots. The bridges and transitions were awful. And the substance of it, I think at one point he went talking about from abortion to moving the embassy in Israel to Jerusalem.
Right.
It made no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
Substantively, he was kind of all over the place. At times, it seemed like he was trying to take credit for, you know, 100 women being elected to, and I guess in an odd sort of way, he can take credit for that.
Right.
But to me, the sort of the big takeaway was, this was a 2020 presidential election speech.
Yeah, it was a MAGA speech for
sure.
Yeah,
this was a MAGA speech. And with the possible sort of traditional State of the Union throwaways to folks in the gallery, you know, when you're spending your time talking about World War II vets and young kids with cancer, I'm not sure that you're landing kind of the punches you need to. There was very little sort of substance to it other than kind of we need to work together. Not particularly memorable. I think, you know, we're under the gun time-wise.
Yeah.
And I wonder if they've advanced anything in terms of trying to deal with the potential new shutdown.
Yeah, I mean, the audience wasn't necessarily in the room, right? Those Democrats aren't going to back him on a lot of these things. He needs to get traction in the public. He needs to bring up the temperature of the sort of problem at the border, the crisis of immigration. I think he probably materialized that and dramatized that in a way, but I'm just not sure it's going to sell. This is also not the kind of thing you can do in a one-stop thing. He's got to do that for week after week. We'll see if it works.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer who assures us that the state of the podcast is strong, Ernie Manouse. Special kudos to our web and graphics team at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, no collusion, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.